I want to begin. So the Shirim Shel Yom, the songs for the days of the week. So here's the interesting thing about those psalms. I feel like even, and maybe you would even say especially, for people who regularly daven, right? These psalms are more muttered than thought about or understood. I think they are very, like, people are like on their way out, or they're just getting there, depending on when your shul does the Shir Shel Yom. And like, it's just very few people actually stop and think about what's going on in these texts. So what I want to try to do is just that. I want to try to walk through these texts, think about what they might mean, and hopefully leave us with some more interesting relationship with them as a result. I'm going to start by reading Psalm 24, the Psalm for Sunday, in Hebrew and English. Julia will also share it in the chat. I would prefer not to screen share because that way I can see many of you, which I much, much prefer, and you can see each other. I'm going to read and translate, and then we'll walk through it. L'David mizmor, l'adunai ha'aretz umloa, tevel v'yoshveva. For David, or of David, a psalm. The earth is the Lord's and everything that it contains, the world and everyone who dwells within it. Ki hu al yamim yisada ve'al ne'arot yechoneneha. Because God founded it upon the sea and on some kind of streams, God established and set it. Mi ya'ale v'har Adonai u'mi yakum bimkom kocho. Who may ascend the mountain of Adonai, and who may stand in God's holy place? Neki chapayim uvar levav, asher lo nasa lashav nafshi v'lo nishba l'mirma. One who is clean of hands and pure of heart, who has not, this is a really hard one to translate, who has not, will go with, falsely sworn by my God's life, nor sworn to a lie. Yisav racha me'et Adonai utzdaka me'lohei yisho. He shall carry away a blessing from God and righteousness from the Lord of his salvation. The God of his salvation, I should say. Zed dor dor shav mefakshei fanecha Yaakov sela. What that verse means, your guess is as good as mine. This is the circle of those who seek God, those who seek your face, Jacob, or maybe God of Jacob, Selah, whatever that means. Se'u she'arim roshechem v'hinasu pitrei olam v'yavo melech hakavod. Gates, lift up your heads. Raise up high, you doors that are eternal, so that the King of Glory may come in. Mize melech hakavod, Adonai izuz v'gibor, Adonai gibor milchama. Who is the King of Glory? The Lord, mighty and powerful. The Lord, mighty, mighty in war. Se'u she'arim rasheichem, se'u pitrei olam, v'yavo melech hakavod. Lift up your heads, O gates. Lift them, you doors that are eternal, and let the King of Glory come in. Mi hu zeh melech hakavod, who then is the King of Glory? Adonai tzvaot, the Lord of armies, the Lord of hosts. Hu melech hakavod, he is the King of Glory, Selah. Okay, so one of the many things that may cross your mind when you first hear this psalm, or read it slowly, is that it isn't totally clear how the various parts hang together. That this psalm is very odd. And in fact, in the way of academic source critics on the Bible, there are people who say, oh yeah, this is really three separate psalms, verses 1 and 2, verses 3 and 6, verses 7 and 10. I'm in general not a fan of that approach, first of all, because it's totally speculative, and second of all, because it doesn't take seriously that even if it's true, those who put texts together into one text have something they're trying to do. They're not like throwing pieces of paper down a stairwell and seeing which land on the same stair. So, in other words, what is the person who's doing this trying to say. So we can say that the psalm opens in the first two verses with a celebration of God as creator. It moves to some kind of scene in verses 3 to 6, to a scene of pilgrims entering the temple. And then from verses 7 to the end, a scene of the ark entering the temple as well. Now, one of the things that we'll see as we go is this beautiful image, I think, of God coming into human space and humans coming into divine space, right? A kind of mutual invitation to enter into one another's space, which I think is a really arresting religious image to think about. At the risk of stating the obvious, I'll note, I'm going to dive into the verses in a minute, but I'll just note, each of the second two parts of this psalm has a rhetorical question or rhetorical questions followed by their answers. And that suggests at least the possibility that at some point in ancient Israelite history, these psalms were recited antiphonally. That is, one person or one group of people would recite a question, and the other group of people or another group would recite the answers. Can't know that, but it's like worth speculating, perhaps. This psalm, as many of you know, is recited on Monday and Thursday morning and on Shabbat afternoons, as well as on Yontif, appropriately enough, when the Torah is returned to the Ark, which is a play with the last four verses of this psalm about the ark. We'll see what I mean by that in a little while, about the ark being brought back into the Beit HaMikdash, into the temple. And although I can't really explain how some of these psalms connect to the days that they have become attached to, I think this one is very likely the theme of creation may help explain why this psalm is connected to the first day of the week. We come out of Shabbat, we enter the first day of the week, it's the first day of creation, and we begin by celebrating God as creator. In the first two verses, which we're now going to turn inside, right, we hear essentially that God tamed the primeval waters and founded the earth on them. And here, this may not be familiar to everyone, so I want to kind of take a step back and say, if you live in the time after Maimonides, which we all do, it is very common to think that creation, oh, that means first there was nothing, and then after that there was something. God made something out of nothing. Yesh mi'ayin, ex nihilo. But in the Bible, that's not what creation is at all. Creation in the Bible is, first there is chaos, swirling forces, and God brings order to the chaos and makes the world habitable for life. If you think about the first verse in the Bible, that's clear even there. I'm going to mispronounce the verse for a minute, the way I suspect it originally read. Bereshit biro Elohim et hashamayim ve ta'aretz. At the beginning of God's creating the heaven and the earth, ve ha'aretz hayta tohu vavohu. And the world was a sweltering mess. That is not creation ex nihilo, right? It is about a God who sees a mess and then starts moving things in one direction or another, making the world habitable. The background to all this, and if this sounds very kind of foreign to you, just bear with me for a few minutes, please. The background is a combat myth that was common all over the ancient Near East. A warrior god battles a monster that threatens the world, wins the battle, and returns to the assembly to be crowned as the supreme god. I suspect very strongly that that image of a combat myth lies in the background of these opening verses. That is, God, al yamim yisada, God built the world upon these storming waters and established it on these streams. Now, just to sort of belabor this point for a minute, how does a god, I'm talking here about the ancient Near East, how does a god in a polytheistic world become recognized by the other gods as king of the gods? And the answer is by doing the one thing that makes possible the universe's survival and flourishing. No other God can do it except for the strongest God, the goddess God, if you will. The defeat of chaos was that victory. And it is interesting here to know that in the ancient Near East, in Canaanite epics, don't worry, we will not be spending our time talking about Canaanite epics because I don't want you all to pass out and fall asleep as I'm talking, at least not at the beginning of the first session, okay? But in the Canaanite epics, Baal becomes king once he vanquishes two gods named Yam and Nahar. Here, the psalmist declares, okay, you want to talk about vanquishing Yam and Nahar? River and a sea and river? Okay, but the one who did that is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. He's the real God. And this is the kind of polemic you see everywhere in Tanakh. You have the things that are attributed to Baal or other gods whom the Tanakh thinks of as idols or false gods or lesser gods, and the attribution of those qualities to, as it were, God. Okay? So now, turning to the actual verses themselves, L'Adonai ha'aretz umlo'ah. God's, the earth and everything is in it, belongs to God. I should say, by the way, the Septuagint has in this verse, sorry, I should have said this a minute ago, L'David mizmor, it adds to that for the first day of the week. Because this was probably a practice that went back all the way into the Second Temple. L'Adonai ha'aretz umlo'ah, L'Adonai, L'Hashem, is an emphatic. To God and no other God. Or to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and no other God. No other God defeated the forces of chaos and thus made the world his own. No God, but God. Okay? Or to put it in a different way, there's a polemic here. L'Adonai ha'aretz umlo'ah. Velola Marduk, Velola Baal, Velola, right? None of those gods. The world belongs to God. And on another level, there's yet another polemic. The world belongs to God and not to the forces of chaos. L'Adonai ha'aretz umloa. It belongs to God, not to the forces that threaten to run wild and overrun and destroy anything, everything. I think, by the way, that one of the things that means is that when we get to the third part of the psalm, when God comes back to the temple, it means that God is not an invader, but a king who's coming home. It already belongs to God. God is coming into God's house, if you will. Okay? Now, L'Hashem ha'aretz umlo'ah is a dramatic statement. You could argue that it's one of the sentences that encapsulates an awful lot of biblical theology, right? God owns the world because it is, its very functioning is the consequence of work God did, right? Now, I want to throw out this sentence and say that I hope we'll have a chance to come back to it, but we might not, in which case I'm happy to talk to people about this on some other occasion, right? On the one hand, the Bible claims that God has created the world by defeating chaos. On the other hand, and often at the very same time, the Bible claims that God is currently creating the world by struggling to defeat chaos. And on the third hand, if you will, there is, wait a minute, chaos doesn't seem defeated at all. And that's the anguish of many very different kinds of psalms. Tevel v'yoshveva. Yoshveva is a fancy biblical Hebrew way of saying those who dwell in it. You may notice that grammatically it's a little odd if you have Hebrew. And then verse 2, ki hu al yamim yisada, the emphatic personal pronoun is again important here, for it was he who founded it. And here, bear with me on the gender issues, because I want to get the pronouns accurate, even though that might not be my pronouns of choice here. But ki hu al yamim yisadat, because it was God who established it upon the sea. Now, I want to just note that yisada in biblical Hebrew can mean established it or is establishing it. And that may be a deliberate ambiguity. Again, as I indicated a minute ago, is this something that happened in the past at a particular moment? Or is this an ongoing activity that God is involved here? And before we leave this first section of the psalm, I think it's worth noting that there is a wonderful, almost bizarre paradox in verse 2. God establishes the earth firmly on top of, wait for it, water. Now, I am not an engineer. In fact, I can barely screw in a light bulb. However, it is clear to me that were I to try to build a long-lasting, untottering, unshakable house, probably building it on a stream would be a bad call. Right? I would look for a boulder or some kind of, you know, right, incredibly strong something to put it on. And I suspect that this is part of the Bible's audacity in saying, yeah, the fact that the world exists and persists is a miracle. Now, yes, I have to say miracle is one of my least favorite words because almost no one has any idea what they mean when they say it. But the point is, it defies our rational explanation. That's what the world is. The world is, if you prefer, here's an evasive term. The existence and persistence of the world is a wonder. Only God could have done this. Only God can take the least stable substance there is and establish a world that will not totter on top of it. Okay. Part two of this psalm, verse 3 and onward. You may notice on the source sheet, that Julia has shared, that these verses have a kind of parallel in Psalm 15, that is source 2, where, right, Mizmor le David, Adonai mi yagur beoholecha mi yishgon behar kochecha, God, who may visit in your tent, who may, dwell in your on your holy mountain, and then the answer is some combination of ethics and religious integrity. Holech tamim ufoel tzedek vedover emet vilvavo, one who lives without blame and does the right and in his heart acknowledges what's true, etc., etc. Okay? These are a kind of a pair of passages. And you can say in a way that what's happening here is either a kind of scrutiny that takes place at the gate, like you're about to come in and you're asked, are you the kind of person who deserves to be here? Or it may just be a hymn and a song, right? In other words, it may represent an actual practice, or it may be just a kind of hymn. One of the things I like to say, which is completely, I mean, it is simple-minded in the extreme, but I think it's a little bit helpful, is that in Judaism, you have two impulses. I'm going to call them the Chabad impulse and the prophetic impulse. The Chabad impulse is, oh, you want to come in and do something Jewish? Great. Come in and do a mitzvah. I ask no questions. The prophetic is, you want to come in and do a mitzvah? Who are you? Do you live with integrity? Does what you're about to do reflect a kind of holistic way of being in the world? The danger of the Chabad outlook is that you admit scoundrels. The danger of the prophetic outlook is you don't give people a chance to kind of grow. This is very much, if you will, the prophetic outlook. It says, who can come in, right? Mi yale behar Hashem, who may ascend the mountain of God? Umi yakum bimkom kocho, who may stand in God's holy place? And the answer is, neki chapayim, someone whose hands are clean, that is, who has not committed crimes of exploitation. Neki chapayim does not mean ritual purity, right? It means like a proper relationship to one's neighbor. Uvar levav, and pure of heart. For those of you who have heard me say ad nauseum over the years, that Jewish ethics and spirituality are obsessed with the integration of the inner and the outer, between what goes on in my heart and what I do with my body, This is a great example of a biblical expression of that. Neki chapayim, clean of hands, that is action. Uvar levav, purity of heart. Cleanliness of hands is first, but it is not exclusive. One also is required to at least strive for purity of heart. And then this phrase that I mentioned is extremely difficult. It is probably the hardest phrase in this psalm, or one of the two, I should say, phrases that's hard to parse. Asher lo nasa lashav nafshi, which does not make a huge amount of sense. First of all, God is not usually referred to as a nefesh. Much more likely is that this psalm originally read Asher lo nasa lashav nafsho, who has not, and in fact, by the way, several manuscripts have this, so I'm not making this up. Several ancient manuscripts of the Hebrew Bible have the phrase Asher lo nasa lashav nafsho. If you look at your source sheet for a minute, I believe that I put this in the source sheet. Yeah. If you are committed to keeping, as it were, the text as we've received it, you have no choice, I think, but to turn to Exodus 20, verse 7, where we are told, Lo tisa shem Hashem Elohecha lashav. You shall not swear falsely by the name of God. So Asher lo nasa lashav nafshi would be some kind of God saying, this person did not swear falsely by my being. Something like that. However, it may very well be that this is meant to read, as I said, Asher lo nasa lashav nafsho, and that can mean to worship idols, to essentially dedicate yourself, commit yourself to a falsehood, namely an idol. Now, this may be deliberately ambiguous. That is to say, it's actually kind of wonderful if you think about it this way. Those who truly follow God and are worthy of entering God's temple do not swear to idols and do not swear falsely by my name. That is to say, their relationship with God is manifest in integrity, both in their relationship with God and in their relationship with their neighbor. If this is a deliberate ambiguity, it's very well done. It's like a very like powerful poetic move. And then lo nishba lemirma, I think, means using God's name wrongly in oaths. So either you're saying two different things, idolatry and false oath, or you're saying one thing twice, which is about falsehood in oaths. Now, to belabor the point I made a moment ago about the integration of the inner and the outer, I wanted to just quickly show you Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi's comment on this verse, because it's actually very, very astute. He says, this is at the bottom of page 2 of the source sheet. Commenting on this, he says, V'hine hiskir shlosha tchunot ha'adam b'pasuk zeh. Notice here that all three aspects of the human being are mentioned here. Hama'aseh, deeds, hamachshava, thought or inner life, v'hadibur, speech. U'vishloshtam yeh ha'adam shalem, and a person should have integrity and wholeness in all three domains, in what we do, in what we feel or think, and in what we say. Okay? So I think that's, you know, Radak's taking my point, if you will, even further. That's a completely ridiculous formulation, but you understand what I was trying to say. That's verse 4. Verse 5, continuing, the implication or consequence, if you will, of someone of integrity coming up to the mountain. Yisavirachah me'et Adonai utzdakam Elohei Yisho. If this is coming to celebrate the victorious deity, if you will, God, right? Then receiving bracha and tzedaka might mean being allowed to kind of benefit from the fruits of an orderly functioning world. Yisav racha me'et Hashem, utzdaka me'lohe yisho. They may participate in and enjoy that which God makes possible. Bracha, by the way, can on some occasions mean salvation. So yisav racha me'et Hashem could mean will be saved by God. And then tzedaka would mean vindication, and that would be like a parallelism. Or it might just mean, as I say, something more general. The word tzedakah, as many of you know, is an elusive word. Here, I think your two best bets are vindication or righteousness. Tzedakah can mean victory, salvation, or it can mean that which is right, that which is just. And probably both meanings apply here. The person who obeys God's laws is a just person and therefore achieves or is granted vindication by God. Okay. Now, just because I love stuff like this, I don't have any great riff on this, but I will just ask you to note that the person who lives with integrity is described as asher lo nasa lashav nafshi, with the word nasa. And then in the very next verse, we hear that he is yisa viracha. So maybe you can translate this, quoting from an obscure article in Biblical Studies, the one who is not carried away by fraud shall carry away a blessing from the Lord. Something like that, meaning trying to capture the use of the same word nasa, to carry, in both ways, even though it's very hard to render that. It's almost impossible, I think, to render that in good English. Verse 6, the end of unit 2 here. Zed dor dor shav mivakshei fanecha Yaakov sela. Dor can mean group or assembly or circle. So dor can mean either a group or assembly or perhaps a place. It's an odd word, which was probably chosen simply because of the alliteration it makes possible with dorshav. Zed dor dorshav is actually the kind of sound play that Tanakh loves. Dor can also mean generation. That's probably what you most, those of you who speak Hebrew, associate it with. Zed dor dorshav. Question is, who is being spoken of? Is it specifically those people who conform to the criteria of verses 4 and 5? Or is it a claim that all of us here conform to the standards of verse 4 and 5? Yeah, is that, can you nod if that distinction is clear? Meaning, one possibility is it is a subset of the people who are here. We're not going to name who is and who isn't. We can't even really know that. But, you know, those people who are here, they are the ones who are sincerely seeking you. Or is it everyone who's here? What we're saying is this is what people should be like, and we are like that. The second one is, I would say, to use an American catchword of our day, the second one is inclusive and also quite dangerous. You have to be righteous to be in the presence of God. And we are. That's like a weird thing to say. It's a very American thing to say. You know, I'm sorry here for a 1 minute digression, but I always say, if you walked into a shul in Prague in 1640 and said, you are all sinners, people would say, yeah, in Hachinami, yeah, of course we are. We're all sinners. You walk into a shul in Riverdale in 2020, whatever we're in, 2023, and say, you are all sinners, right? They will say, when is the first meeting of the search committee? Because in America, you can't really say things like that because we're all wonderful. But I think there's something to be said for the complexity here, right? There is a cost to saying we're all sinners all the time. And there is very much a cost for saying we're all wonderful all the time. So this psalm, I don't know which one it's saying. Mivakshei fanecha is an interesting term. Those who seek your face. They are seeking not merely to be in God's presence, I think, but also seeking to see God's face shining. That is to receive God's blessing. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha. May God shine God's face on you is a way of saying, may God's blessings pour forth on you. Now, Yaakov and Sela are both very difficult. And here I'm inclined to say several manuscripts and the Septuagint and the Syriac all have Elohe Yaakov Sela. That is to say, Zed Dor Dor Shav Mivakshei Fanecha Elohe Yaakov Sela, who seek your face, O God of Jacob. Otherwise, you have to say those who seek your face, comma, who are Jacob. Just a little odd. And as for what the word Selah means, your guess is likely as good as mine. It is common, though far from universal among scholars, to assume that Selah somehow indicates a transition from one subject to another, most likely experienced through the playing of instruments. That is not a universal claim, a universally agreed upon assumption. Okay, part three of the psalm. Te'usharim Rasheichem. These verses seem like they are about God entering God's temple. The temple gates open for the ark, which is a symbol of God's presence, a manifestation of God's presence. I really don't know what the right word here is. That's a really interesting question about biblical theology and spirituality, right? But the temple gates are invited to open so that the ark, and again, I say this with some hesitancy, and the God who comes along with it may enter. Now, I'm going to do one more moment of taking you into the recesses of obscure ancient Near Eastern myth that may help us understand what's happening here. Okay? There is a Ugaritic text in which the assembly of the gods sees the messengers of Yam approaching and gets scared. And so they lower their heads onto their knees. They bury their heads in fear. And Baal, the storm god, gets mad and says, "You are a bunch of craven wimps. Stand up proudly before the messengers." He tells them, in Ugaritic, "Lift up your heads. Se'u Rasheichem." Later in the story, Baal will defeat Yam and will presumably tell them again, "Stand up, because he's been defeated. Announce my triumphant return." It is possible that in these verses, the poet or the author of this psalm is kind of taking this image and reimagining it as the gates of the temple are kind of courtiers waiting for Hashem to return. To return from what? We'll talk about in a minute. This is a highly mythological image, obviously. Now, what these verses mean re-raises the question of how the three parts of this psalm are related. Now, again, some scholars think they're just not related. The psalm is baffling and we can't really make sense of it. I think that we can talk bigadol, sort of writ large, about a kind of progression. Part one proclaims God's victory, which attracts worshipers to come and celebrate this God who has defeated chaos. Part two is a kind of entrance liturgy, which makes clear that only those who have been loyal to God are welcome to share in the fruits of God's victory. And then part three is like when the president shows up to the White House party. The problem is that the presupposition of verses 3-6 seems to be that God is already sitting on Mount Zion and that other people wish to have the right to come there to visit God. The presupposition of verses 7-10 appears to be that God is outside of Mount Zion and would now like to be re-welcomed in. This gives some credence to the idea that this author is taking pieces of liturgy and weaving them into a whole. But again, the work of interpretation is not the relatively simple claim of, oh, these were originally different texts, but actually trying to figure out what is the theology that he is trying to weave by weaving these together. And again, I would still stand behind some version of God wins, people want to visit, and then God shows up to celebrate with the celebrators. There's a wonderful comment. John Golden Gay, a contemporary evangelical Christian Bible scholar, talking about the relationship between verse 2 and 3, and he admits this is a homily. This is not like a like careful interpretation of the text, but he says, God can be both within the community and knocking on its door at the very same time. And that would be how the two images of verses 3 to 6 and verses 7 to 10 might live together. God can be within the community and yet knocking on its door. I would say that's a description from a Jewish perspective of how God works all the time, right? I mean, think about the Rosh Hashanah liturgy, which is essentially this bizarre back and forth. God is king. God is not king. Have you seen the way Julia conducts her life? God is not king. God will one day be king. Well, on one level, God is king now because God is God. And on another level, God is not yet God. That's a lot of biblical theology in a nutshell, I think. Not the part about Julia, but the part about God. Now, Se'u She'arim, lift up your heads. Now, on one level, this might be a metaphor for joy. But others actually think, no, this is actually an image that might have other kinds of meaning. So let's just sort of like map out what they could mean. Again, one, Lisa Rosh can mean to act joyously, proudly, right? Because the opposite, if you think about it, is one that we're familiar with. To put your head down is a position of resignation or sadness, right? Because someone who puts their head between their knees. Ben Summer actually translates Usharim Roshechem as rejoice, O gates, as opposed to the more literal, lift up your heads, O gates. Now, Pitchei Olam, what on earth does that mean? The other day, I was looking at the Sidur, what's it called? The new conservative movement, Sidur, Lev Shalem. Lev Shalem translates Pitchei Olam as doorways to eternity. That is really lovely, but that is not the pshat. There's no way it means that. I don't think. How's that for a hedge? There's no way it means that, I don't think. There you have, by the way, my entire personality in a nutshell. But okay, right? It doesn't mean that. So what does it mean? I think that somehow, at minimum, this place, this physical place on earth, like a building on a mountain in an actual city called Jerusalem, right? This building is somehow tied in with the eternity of God, right? They are the doors that are connected to the God who is from one end of time to the other. But I think there might be two simpler meanings too, which is one, eternal doors, meaning doors that will never be destroyed. Some of the Psalms seem to think, these are, I think you would call them songs of Zion, that Jerusalem will never be destroyed and that the temple is impregnable. By the way, that is a major theme in Isaiah and something that Jeremiah rails against furiously. That a theology that assumes Jerusalem is impregnable is a theology that makes for extremely complacent, self-satisfied believers. No city, not even Jerusalem, can take the presence of God for granted. So, but one thing this might mean is that if this is of a piece, after all, this is a temple psalm, is that if this is of a piece with Psalms like 46 and 48, it means doors that will never be destroyed. It's also possible, in the ancient Near East, it was common to believe that a temple was built by the God who dwelled there at the very beginning of time. That idea, as Ben Summer has noted, would be odd in the Bible, which tends to assume that Moshe or Shlomo built the house of God. Moshe built the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and Shlomo built the temple, the Beit HaMikdash. However, it's extremely likely that the biblical writers were aware of this idea of the temple is built by God, God's self, in which case Pitchei Olam might mean doors that have been there forever. Okay. Now, Melech HaKavod, and this I think will leave some people not like totally comfortable because I think this is harder stuff in some ways. The image here, I think, is some kind of triumphant return of God to God's earthly dwelling place after some kind of military victory. However you wrestle with this kind of thing, or however you make sense of it, we have to acknowledge that in a variety of biblical texts, God is understood as, among other things, a quote-unquote divine warrior. Okay? And the temple becomes, in at least parts of the Israelites' thinking, not just a place for sacred worship, but also a kind of citadel where God is ensconced in some way. We're going to see that on, when's the next class, Julia? Thursday? On Thursday when we do the Psalm for Monday, which is a psalm about Jerusalem. I should mention here, at the risk of flipping some people out, that Ben Summer from JTS has argued very strongly that the term kavod can refer to God's body, whatever that means. And that melech ha-kavod, the divine body, which was seen as stunningly bright and radiant. So melech ha-kavod, the kavod would refer to the literal entry of God's presence somehow into the temple through a gate. Here is one thing I will not be discussing in this course. Does the Bible think that God has a body or bodies? And what should we as contemporary Jews do to make sense of that? I hereby refer you to someone else. Okay, now, I do have some things to say about that, but I'm not going to say them here. Mi ze melech ha-kavod? Who is the king? Mi ze, as opposed to mi. I think mi ze implies the ze, a kind of emphatic. Who, in truth, is the King of Glory? And the answer is Hashem Izuz v'gibor, God who is mighty and valiant. I love this comment because it gives you a little bit of like the ancient feel of this text. A Bible scholar named J.G.M. Roberts writes the following. The King of Glory is Yud-Heh Vav-Heh. That is, he is not Baal or El, as the Canaanites might claim. He is not Dagon, as the Philistines say, or Chemosh of the Moabites, or Milcom of the Ammonites. The real King of Glory is Yud-Heh Vav-Heh. If I were feeling inflammatory, which of course I am not, I might say, God is the King of Glory. Not mammon, not power, not the global market, not advertising, not reputation or branding, right? No, God is God, and only God is God. God alone is God. Now, Izuz v'gibor is really important because it means, I think, God has the power to actually deliver creation, to save it from threats. Meaning, you know how in like contemporary Jewish thought, there's all these versions of a God of limited power? That is not the theology of these Psalms. God is strong enough to ensure that the world will endure, persist, flourish. And then, of course, again, you have all these other Psalms that say, really? You could have fooled me based on my experience of how brutal and brutalizing the world really is, right? Okay. Now, in verse 9, Se'u she'arim rasheichem u'se'u pitchei olam, I'm descending to the level of like very, very careful readings. Se'u pitchei olam doesn't make a lot of sense because it doesn't have a direct object, right? So more likely, as in verse 7, it should read, v'hinas'u pitchei olam, meaning hinas'u is raise yourselves. Su'u is carry, but carry what? Right? You just don't have that in this text. And then in verse 10, mihu ze melech ha-kavod, mihu ze is a kind of double emphatic. Ben Summer translates verse 10 as, who then is really the King of Glory, right? Hashem Tzva'ot, the God of hosts. Now, the term the Lord of hosts is a term that is convenient for many American Jews because it allows them to use a term they don't really even know what, we don't even know what we mean by that. But hosts are armies, right? So the term is not common in Tehillim, but it emphasizes the idea that God leads the heavenly hosts in battle and is associated with the ark, which, according to Shmuel Aleph, could go out in front of the Israelites in battle. That was not an English sentence, but I hope you understand what I just tried to say, right? The ark was like the symbol. Again, I'm not sure it's a symbol. It might be something more real than that, if you will. The ark was a kind of somehow the expression of God going out in battle with the people. And here, the triumphant God is returning home. But here, it's not, I think, that God defeated some historical enemy of Israel, but rather that God defeated the forces of chaos and thereby established the world and made it habitable for human and other forms of life. Now, I want to just say a couple of quick things in concluding this psalm, and then I'm willing to stay for a couple of extra minutes if there are a lot of questions. Surely you'll tell me if there are. One is that it was common practice in the ancient Near East to take statues of gods out and then bring them back in a few days later on a parade. And some ancient cultures, Ben Sommer has written about this, believed that God was actually present in the statue, so that on some level they were actually parading around their God. Did the Israelites believe this? I don't know. Now, this notion that the ark went out to war also seems to play a role in, if you look at your source sheets on page 3, familiar to you probably from liturgy, right? That God traveled above them when they moved on from camp, Vayihi bin Soah Aaron, and when the ark traveled, Moshe said, "Arise, O God, everyone get out of the way. God is coming." The last thing I want to observe, and then I will take like one question, is that for rabbinic Judaism, the place taken by a statue comes to be taken by words. According to Devarim, I'm not confident I know what this means, but I'm at least going to play with this for a minute. What is found in the temple is God's shem, God's name, a word. And here's an interesting example of this, of where Devarim shifts and makes possible rabbinic Judaism. In the ancient Near East, people would put statues of their gods in doorposts or wear them on their own bodies. In Devarim, those are replaced by mezuzot and tefillin, which contain words. They are not statues. There is something really interesting going on there about somehow that words over time become the kind of mode of, I don't know, conveying, capturing the presence and power of God. I don't think you have that yet here. Although the practice of singing this when a Sefer Torah is returned to the Ark is very much a kind of Deuteronomic rabbinic vision, I think, which is how do we experience God's presence in these words which we're parading around rather than this picture that we're parading around. Okay. Thank you, Julia, for moderating. Thank you, all of you, for being with me. And I look forward to seeing you on Thursday.